This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we're going to talk about the life and legacy of a powerful Illinois lawmaker, W. Russell Arrington. Arrington, an Evanston Republican, is credited by many as modernizing the General Assembly. He introduced legislative staffers to the legislature. This helped boost the power of state lawmakers, putting them on a more even footing with the executive branch. He helped set up the Legislative Audit Commission. He also helped push through the Illinois state income tax. Arrington long opposed such a tax, but he joined forces with Governor Richard Ogilvie and ushered the bill through the state house. Why? We'll take up that question and others with our guest this afternoon, former St. Louis Post-Dispatch political correspondent Taylor Pensino. Taylor Pensino is the author, most recently, of Powerhouse, Arrington from Illinois. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to Powerhouse, Taylor Pensino is the author of a biography of Richard Ogilvie and co-author of a biography of Dan Walker. He's also the author of a work of fiction, Brothers Notorious, The Sheltons, and The Summer of 50. Powerhouse, Arrington from Illinois, is a heritage special edition from the American Literary Press. Net proceeds from sales of the book will be donated to the Robert R. McCormick Boys and Girls Club. Again, the phone number is 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Taylor, good to speak with you again. How are you?
Hi, Celeste. How are you?
I'm fine.
To be with you on the Afternoon Magazine.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Arrington and Jim Edgar. Former Governor Jim Edgar was one of what was called Arrington's Army, and he wrote the foreword for this book, Powerhouse. What did Jim Edgar learn as a result of being an aide to Arrington?
Well, that's a good way to start, Celeste. Jim Edgar, former Governor Edgar, considers himself a protege of Senator Arrington. He considers him his political mentor. And I think after all these years that Arrington remains the man in public life that Governor Edgar still respects the most. He wanted to write the foreword to the book because Jim Edgar felt for years that a book on Arrington was necessary, that Arrington's accomplishments, what Arrington stood for, what he represented, shouldn't be relegated to the dustbins of Illinois history. And Governor Edgar was a young intern here in the late 1960s. He was one of the earlier interns. He was assigned to Arrington. He was on Arrington's staff. After his internship was over, he became, for a few years, a paid staff member of Arrington. And those were, in Governor Edgar's words, the formative years of his life, really. The work ethic that Arrington espoused, the 100% effort that Arrington demanded, the fear, frankly, that Arrington instilled in not only interns but other legislators if they didn't live up to what Arrington considered their potential. Arrington was just a major force in the lives of many individuals, and right at the head of the list would be Governor Edgar. He was delighted to write the foreword to the book. It was sort of funny, if I can give you one anecdote. Back
sure.
when Jim Edgar was governor of Illinois in the 1990s, I was then the president of the Illinois Coal Association, and we would have various bill signings where the governor would sign bills that were intended to help Illinois Coal in one way or another. And at that time, I was working on the biography of Governor Richard Ogilvie, and every time we would be at a in a two- or three-year period there when it would be a bill signing where Governor Edgar would be signing a bill and I would be on the platform with him, at some point he would get me aside and say, how is the Ogilvie coming? And I would say, just fine, Governor. And then he would always say, you're going to be sure to give Arrington his due, aren't you?
Yeah.
I said, you bet. And that's because Governor Ogilvie is regarded as one of the, certainly by far, one of the better governors of Illinois. And Arrington, who then was the powerful leader of the Republican majority in the Illinois Senate, made sure that much of Ogilvie wanted got passed and was really responsible for much of the success of the Ogilvie administration. So, you know, Governor Edgar really had a hand in encouraging the Arrington book.
Yeah. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, because this has been a few years, and I've been out of reporting on politics for quite a while now. But when Governor Edgar was running for re-election, facing Neil Hartigan, Governor Edgar proposed making a temporary increase in the income tax permanent.
He did.
Were Arrington and Ogilvie in 1969 far from Jim Edgar's thoughts?
Well, it's a good question, and I've never heard it quite raised that way before. But first of all, you're right about Governor Edgar and the income tax. When he was running for governor back the first time in 1990, Edgar was a first-hand witness to what happened in 1969. That was a very tumultuous year here, a major year. That was Ogilvie's first year in office, and that's the year that the Ogilvie called for passage of the state income tax, and Arrington was the man who rammed it through. Arrington was the only legislator that had the power and the expertise at that time to get the initial state income tax passed, and he did it. It made him sick to do it, I will tell you that, you and the listeners, but he did it. He did it because he felt it was the right thing to do. It had to be done, and partisan politics aside, somebody sooner or later had to bite the bullet, to take the bull by the horns, and directly address the income tax issue, get one passed. The state otherwise was facing bankruptcy, and Ogilvie proposed it. Arrington got it passed. Jim Edgar was a first-hand witness to that whole scenario back in 1969, and I think that what he witnessed there made impressions upon Jim Edgar that still were being felt in the man who later himself became governor of Illinois. Mm.
What was the state's fiscal condition in the late 1960s?
It was dire. More revenue was needed. Efforts were being made by reformers and others to upgrade Illinois government, to make it more responsive to the citizenry of Illinois. And obviously, some things had to be changed. The state government had to be a lot more, had to get a lot more involved in things going on at the time. As you recall, the 1960s were a decade of great upheaval. And however, the revenue wasn't there. We were looking at deficit budgets. The main income source at that time for state government was the sales tax, and that could only produce so much. And you can only get so much by increasing the gas tax or the so-called sin taxes, the taxes on cigarettes, liquor, things like that. A major new source of revenue had to be found. The income tax was the only answer. Illinois was one of, then I think, a minority of states that did not have a state income tax. And like everybody knew, it was going to have to come sooner or later. It was just a matter of what individual would finally decide to go ahead and actually propose it. And to his credit, Richard Ogilvie, as governor, in his first year as governor in office, 1969, in his first budget message, which he ironically introduced on April Fool's Day, he did call for, he did call for passage of the first state income tax. Of course, at first, everybody was just abhorred at the thought. Everyone knew it was needed, but nobody wanted to go on record as supporting it. Arrington was the Senate leader, the most powerful legislator, as I've said, and Ogilvie asked Arrington to be the main sponsor of the income tax bill. There's an interesting anecdote that are in my books that when Ogilvie had a private meeting a few days ahead of time before the budget presentation with Republican legislative leaders, there were just a few there, Ogilvie said at that point that I am going to call for passage of a state income tax. And Arrington famously said, Governor, what fool is going to handle that bill? And Ogilvie looked at Arrington and said, you, Russ. Mm. And you could have heard a pin drop in the room. I mean, nobody said a word. You know, it's one of those deals where everybody looks at the ceiling or looks at the floor. And then finally, Arrington said, if that's what you want, Governor, then I will do it. But I will tell you, Arrington was sick to his stomach for 3 or 4 days afterwards, hardly ate anything, because he had always been a major opponent of the income tax. And he was a Republican, a moderate Republican on social issues, but pretty conservative fiscally. And this just ran against the grain, and those privy to that very dramatic encounter were just shocked that Arrington agreed to do it. But he did it, and it became one of the overriding themes of that 1969 session of the General Assembly. And, of course, it was fought out and worked out and maneuvered, the dealings and all that. Everything went on right up until the final two nights of the session at the end of June that year. But Arrington got it done. And I guess we all have to say, where would we be now in Illinois with state government if not for the income tax?
Why did he change his mind? Why did he? Was it because he held Ogilvie in esteem? Did he reluctantly realize that, yeah, this is the way out of the mess we're in? What happened?
I think all of the above. Arrington realized that the state was in a fiscal straitjacket. That Illinois was not going to move ahead. In fact, it was going to slip backwards without the revenue that only the income tax could produce. He was a Republican. Ogilvie was the first Republican in office since the 1950s. Earlier, throughout the 1960s, Democrats Otto Kerner and Sam Shapiro were in the governorship, and Arrington wanted the Republican governor to succeed. He personally liked Ogilvie. When Ogilvie was considering running for governor back in 1967, a year before the election, he had had a private meeting in his Chicago law office with Ogilvie, and at that point, Ogilvie had said that, Russ, if you want to run for governor, be the party's nominee for governor, I will not run. I want to run, but not if you want to be the nominee. And it was at that point that Arrington said that no, he in spite of entertaining the thought about running for governor, he said that he would not run for governor and that he would support Ogilvie, which he did. So they liked each other. There was great respect between the two. There was always a respectful relationship. And Arrington felt it was the right thing to do. That was the underlying motive for Arrington, irrespective of who was coming down where politically. If it was the right thing to do, then you went ahead and did it. You know, we haven't seen a lot of that in recent years in Illinois government, but that was Arrington's philosophy. He knew the income tax was needed. It still galled him personally when push came to shove and Governor Ogilvie asked him to sponsor the bill. But Arrington did it, and he did a heck of a job, Celeste. I mean, it was just arm twisting and maneuvering and dealing and everything out throughout the rest of the session during 69, but he got it done.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Taylor Pensino. We're talking this afternoon about Illinois state politics, in particular, the leadership of Russell Arrington. Taylor Pensino is the author most recently of Powerhouse, Arrington from Illinois. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you're invited to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now, a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I wonder, this is more of a general question, but as you know, our previous governor is now in jail, and as you know also probably that, in general, Illinois is always considered one of the top five most corrupt states in the Union over the last, as long as I've been around. And I wonder, do you think that's an unfair characterization? And do you think that Ryan could operate the way he did as Secretary of State under Edgar and not have Edgar be in some way knowledgeable of that? Or what's your thought?
Okay, first of all, it's a good question. Unfortunately, the caller is right that Illinois is getting quite a reputation nationally. When people like myself and others go around the country, people do say, what is going on in Illinois with governors going to jail and constant corruption being disclosed. We're getting quite, unfortunately, as I said, the caller is right, we're getting quite a tarnished image here right now. And that's a darn shame. Some states have always been known for political corruption. To be honest, Louisiana would be one. There are a few others, and it's not complimentary that Illinois seems to be sliding into that category. Now, back on the specifics about Jim Edgar. Jim Edgar did precede Governor Ryan as Secretary of State. I've known Jim Edgar fairly well for much of his adult life. Jim ran, I guess the best way to put it in kindergarten language, a very clean ship as Secretary of State. He was very attentive to the various licensing, driver's licensing programs and all the other things the Secretary of State administers. Jim is a very hands-on individual. He does surround himself always with competent people, but he does not isolate himself from what's going on. He gets down there and deals and pays attention to the nitty gritty, and we didn't have with Edgar as Secretary of State the sort of scandals and the disclosures that started to crop up when Ryan was Secretary of State. again, the caller's right in that most of the things for which George Ryan was convicted went back to his days as Secretary of State, not as governor. And George Ryan, I think, in retrospect, made a mistake of entrusting much of the day-to-day operation directives of the Secretary of State's office to a small number of individuals that he entrusted to pretty much run the show. Governor Ryan was not very hands-on, obviously, in those days, as subsequent disclosures showed. And as a result, he's paid a terrible price for it. But Jim Edgar, there's a lot of potential for scandal in the Secretary of State's office. But Jim Edgar, really amassed a very admirable record as Secretary of State. He wasn't touched by scandal, and of course that bode him well then when he ran in 1990 for governor. And one of his big assets was his very clean image.
But, you know, back to the listener's question, though, you know, were party leaders in the GOP aware of what was going on during the tenure of George Ryan in the Secretary of State's office?
You know, again, Celeste, it's an excellent question, and I'm not sure there's one clear-cut answer. There was a recognition all along by those of us around the statehouse world here in Springfield that George Ryan was an old-style politician. He was an old-line guy. He believed in rewarding his friends. He believed in loyalty to individuals who had helped him at one or more stages of his long political career. And some of those individuals had other agendas than the political welfare of George Ryan. So I think the answer is yes. There was definitely a recognition that the Ryan administration, back in the Secretary of State's days, was back to sort of, I'll use the trite phrase, business as usual. That cronies were running the show in various areas, and apparently Ryan was not paying attention. He had many strengths. George Ryan knew everybody. He knew how to get things done. If not for the conviction and the subsequent imprisonment, George Ryan would probably go down as a pretty good governor of Illinois, to be honest, because he had a terrific rapport with the General Assembly. As you know, he had one time been Speaker of the Illinois House when he was a state representative. And he was able to get about everything he wanted from the General Assembly. But allowance of others to have a free hand in dealing with contracts and other touchy items led to situations that prompted his downfall. And there was an image that he was an old-line politician, and many of the things he did had been done for years. They were considered commonplace. But I guess the federal prosecutor's office in Chicago and some others apparently decided to finally draw a line in the sand and say, this is it. We're going to take this guy as an individual who's done things the way many have always done it, and we're going to say no more. And we think there's enough there about him to uncover that he's going to be made an example of.
Let's take another call now. Listener, and our listener rang off. Maybe they'll call back. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, Taylor Pansonneau, author of Powerhouse, Arrington from Illinois. Well, let's get back to Arrington now. And what were his ideas about business as usual? I believe during his tenure, there was some ethics concerns.
Okay, first off, Arrington himself, Celeste, was never touched by scandal. He was a very wealthy man. He made millions through his law practice and successful business ventures that had nothing to do with his role in public life in holding office. He never was on the take. He was personally, actually scrupulously honest in his political career. He was a multimillionaire, as I said. And he himself was above reproach in the sort of things that have come to discolor Illinois government in the minds of many. Now, as a very powerful individual, he was aware of things going on. He didn't like publicity, disclosures, investigations that brought out wrongdoing by public officials, especially other legislators. And Arrington had a trait, and I personally remember, I was the St. Louis Post-Dispatch guy back then, and I personally remember one situation that was symbolic of many where myself and an investigator from the Better Government Association of Chicago went to him with a situation that was brewing but hadn't developed. And it would have been a very deleterious matter if it had gone the full route. But Arrington simply said, let me handle this. And the whole thing was squashed because he had the power to go and tell individuals brewing something that would have been negative. I don't want this to happen, and it better not happen. And the whole matter was dropped. Paul Simon, the late Paul Simon, mm-hmm. I interviewed Simon several times for the Arrington book. Simon had a lot of interaction with Arrington. And it's about 3 weeks before Paul Simon died, my last interview with Simon, in talking about Arrington, Simon said that Arrington himself was above reproach, and he was truly a great man, but Simon felt that Arrington could have done more to have squelched several scandalous situations that developed back when Arrington was riding high in the Senate and really running the show. And Simon said that would have been a mild criticism of Arrington. He said because Arrington knew everything going on, and as Simon said, you know, Arrington would like to simply dissolve something behind the scene without fanfare and without reading about it in the newspapers or hearing about it on the radio. And Simon said that sometimes that wasn't adequate, and on that grounds, he said he faulted Arrington because he said sometimes. In illegal situations developing there back in mainly the 60s, Simon said that Arrington would have been the one person who could have put the kibosh on it as it was happening, but Arrington didn't always do that, and Simon said that was maybe something where Arrington could have done a better job than he did.
Yeah. Now, before Simon went into politics, went into government, he was a reporter, and he did some reporting about the scene in Springfield.
Yeah, Paul Simon. Paul Simon, at one time, owned a chain of small Illinois newspapers. I think there were 13 or 14 at one time, and ironically, Alan Dixon was handled his business affairs for him. That's how close they were, but. Yeah, Simon, and even after he sold the papers, he continued to write a column right from Springfield that appeared in many Illinois papers. He continued doing this as a state rep and then as a state senator, and And, you know, even as lieutenant governor, he might have continued that, writing the column. And it's sort of funny, you know, because everybody that holds public office, you know, if you ask them what they really are, they never say they're a full-time politician. I mean, everybody says, well, I'm a farmer, I'm a banker, I'm an insurance salesman. Paul Simon always said, well, I'm a journalist. And, you know, he gained his initial reputation. If you want to talk about Paul Simon, you know, he gained his initial reputation when he was only about 19 or 20 years old, and he bought a small newspaper down in Troy, Illinois, a very small newspaper. And within several years, he turned it into a little muckraking tabloid down there. Going into, at the time, this is around 1949, 1950, all the illegal gambling going on down in Madison County. And he gained a lot of attention, and you know, he ran for the Illinois House from down there. And, of course, all the organized machine politicians opposing, nobody gave him a chance. But he got elected, and he was kind of a boy wonder. You know, he was elected state rep when he was probably only 23, 24 years old. It was kind of incredible, and the rest is history. But it was his small newspaper in Troy that provided a springboard for him to make a name for himself down there, a name respected enough to get him elected to the Illinois House at a very young age. And then he proceeded to buy a lot of other small papers around the state. And as I said, he had a chain of 13 or 14 at one time. But then as his role as a state rep and then as a state senator became more demanding, he divested himself of the newspapers. But he always continued to call himself basically a journalist, not a politician.
Hmm. Among those who credit Arrington with modernizing the legislature is House Speaker Michael Madigan.
Right.
Madigan calls Arrington the father of the modern General Assembly.
Right.
So Madigan then has studied Arrington. What lessons has Madigan drawn from this period of Illinois legislative history?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. I'm often asked who today would be the closest thing to Arrington. And without hesitation, I say Speaker Michael Madigan. Madigan runs the House in a very efficient, hard-handed manner. He instills discipline in the proceedings. It's an orderly situation. It is productive, or should be under Madigan's tutelage. I simply say that Madigan studied well. Or at least he certainly would seem to be aware of the example set by Arrington, although Arrington was a Republican and Madigan a Democrat, and they didn't really cross over. Arrington was fading from the scene here at the time that Madigan first appeared as a young state rep from Chicago. But I interviewed Madigan for the book, and Madigan up front said that, well, no question that, you know, Arrington is the father of the modern Illinois General Assembly. And Madigan intimated that much of the way he's tried to conduct himself as Speaker does mirror the way that Arrington conducted himself back in the days when he was running the state Senate.
Mm. And Madigan is known for top-notch staff.
Yes, he is.
He's very demanding of them.
Very.
This gets us again to Arrington.
Right.
Why was getting aides to lawmakers, staffers, into the State House key to modernizing the General Assembly?
Again, that's a good question. Even when I first came here, I was moved up here by the Post Dispatch from St. Louis to the Illinois State House in late 1965. And even when I arrived, legislators had no offices, no secretaries, not even telephones of their own. All they had were their desks on the floor of the Senate or House. And it was kind of funny, you know, they had these huge stacks of bills piled around their desks. They had no research assistants. They had nobody to help them look into the ins and outs of bills. You know, it was impossible to read all the bills introduced. It was a very, it was a system where, and of course then they only met 6 months every other year also, Celeste. And it was a situation whereby many of them just didn't have the expertise or the time to fully acquaint themselves with the complexities of a lot of the issues they had to consider. And as the years were passing and the demands upon staff state government becoming more and more complex, and that included the General Assembly, it was just becoming obvious that, that they needed some kind of help, some kind of staffing. And as I said, Arrington, more than anybody else, was the one who made all this possible. I should point out that in terms of developing the intern program, he provided the political muscle and the academic muscle. Initiative for it came from Sam Gold, who I'm sure you know, and Sam was then director for years, the highly respected former director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at Champaign-Urbana. And Arrington and Gold proved to be a very effective team in bringing about first interns and then eventually professional staffing. Now, you know, when Arrington started the professional staffing, he brought in two or three people. Now, obviously, two things to point out. They only worked for Senate Republicans, And secondly, there was no tax dollars. There was no appropriation for anything like this at that time. So for the first several years, Arrington, who I said was very wealthy, Arrington paid the salaries, the travel expenses, and the Springfield lodging bills and the meals for these two or three early staffers. He did this for several years. There was no public money involved. He paid for everything. And of course, as I said, they were very bright people, the initial staffers, and they only worked for the Senate Republicans. But I thought it was rather incredible that he did this. And then eventually, in about, it was probably around in 66, 67, appropriations started to provide for staffing for all of the legislative leaders. And that has evolved to where we have a situation today where, you know, the General Assembly really couldn't function without all the professional staffing and the bright people, many of them very young people, who work for, you know, both Democrats and Republicans in both houses. Mm-hmm. But Arrington, again, Arrington started professional staffing down here, and he did it with his own money. Now the salaries weren't great, but he paid for everything out of his own pocket.
Yeah. Now the you mentioned Sam Gove, and I'm really glad you did. He's now an emeritus professor.
Of course,
here.
Yeah.
And I really got a charge out of reading this portion of the book. Arrington called Gove's interns. They weren't Arrington's army. Arrington called them Gove's guerrillas.
That's true. He did.
And there were eventually, you know, interns on the Democratic side of the aisle.
Sure.
And the aides included Don Clark Netsch and Terry Bruce. Are there other names that we would recognize?
Now, technically, Don Clark Netsch was never an intern.
Oh, okay.
She was introduced. She came in here in the early 1960s when Democrat Otto Kern was governor. And while I'm not sure quite where she came from, she surfaced then in the governor's office as a very bright, young, chic assistant to Governor Koerner. She was one of the stars on his staff. She didn't stay two or three years, though. She went off into other things in Chicago and so on. But that's how Don Clark Netsch entered the scene down here. Terry Bruce did come out of the intern program. You're right. He was a Democratic intern. And right after that, he got elected to the state Senate. So Terry Bruce would be a very well-known name that came out of the intern program we're talking about.
Yeah. Who are the staffers of today? Maybe you'd give us a little glimpse in terms of there's professional staff, of course. Maybe we could talk a little bit about interns. Are there's still got to be interns in the State House?
Oh, yeah, there are. Yeah. In fact, I will tell you, the current class of legislative interns, I'm not sure how many there are, 25, 30, that's a guess. One of the books that was required reading for them was the Arrington book. Ron Michelson, political science prof here at the University of Illinois at Springfield, ran sort of an orientation introductory program for the interns out of the university, and one of the requirements for the current group was that they read my Arrington book. And then in their last session, Ron had me out at the university, and then I talked to all the interns, and they asked questions about the book and so on. So, yeah, I got to see firsthand the current crop of legislative interns. and you know, they're very bright young people. You know, some will go on to further careers in public life. Others will spin off into other things, broadcasting, newspapers. A number will become successful, quite successful, in private business ventures. But they're all bright people. It's a tough program to get in. The screening is very tight. But the experience they get of having direct access to the legislative leaders and rank-and-file legislators also is really just incredible. And, you know, it's like a lifetime education wound up in a 6 to 8 month period.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Back again to Arrington. He was a Republican from the North Shore, but his roots were downstate. Tell us about his background in Illinois coal country.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, many people here, when Arrington was riding high, thought he was a blue blood attorney from Chicago, a guy who had always had money from the start and had just made more money with his money. And not many really knew that he came from very sub-modest circumstances in downstate Illinois. He was actually born in Gillespie, Illinois, which is a little bit south of here, as you know, down in Macoupin County. His father worked for the coal mining industry at the time. And when Arrington was in about the 7th or 8th grade, his dad took a job with a railroad in East St. Louis, and the Arrington family moved to East St. Louis. And Arrington actually graduated from East St. Louis High School in 1924. He was a very bright kid in high school, had no money, but a very bright kid. And somehow he went to work for several years in the stockyards in East St. Louis, and he managed to save enough money there. He was an only child. He saved enough money to get to the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. And there he got a bachelor's degree, and he did well. And then he managed to remain there and go to law school, and he graduated I think in 1930, he got his law degree from the University of Illinois School of Law, and he always thought he would probably, you know, be an attorney in some downstate Illinois town. In fact, he actually had an interview, thought he was going to go to work for an individual who had a small office in right around Champaign-Urbana, Paxton, or one of the towns like that. And yet he had met at an Illinois Northwestern game. A woman who went to Northwestern, and they started dating, and they got very serious, but a stipulation. Her mother said that her daughter would never marry any guy that wasn't going to live in Chicago. and so they wanted to get married, and the young woman, his wife, her name was Ruth Brown, indicated that you know, they were going to have to live in Chicago. Her mother was not going to approve, and that was important. So anyway, Arrington got out of law school, passed the bar, and they got married. And almost from the start, they moved to Evanston. I don't think they lived if at all in Chicago itself. They got married on the south side. She was from the south side of Chicago, but. Not long after they were married, they made their home in Evanston in a small apartment at first, but that's what got him to Chicago. I mean, on his own, and I had his own self-dictated memoirs in doing the book. The Arrington family provided that to me. He never thought he would be in Chicago. He thought of himself that he would be a small-town lawyer somewhere in downstate Illinois.
Hmm. What led him into politics?
He became active, actually not long after living in Evanston, he became active in the Young Republican Club of Evanston, which was very powerful and very potent. Evanston and those adjoining North Shore communities back in, now we're talking about the early to mid-1930s, were very strong Republican enclaves in those days. Now, that's not the case anymore. Evanston itself is now very Democratic. But it was very Republican back then, and he became active in young Republican politics, you know, mainly supporting other young individuals who wanted to run for office and so on. And he himself made a bid for office. He ran for the city council in Evanston, I think it was in 1941, and he lost. Not by much, but he lost, and that was the only electoral defeat he ever suffered. But 3 years later, a Republican rep from the area who Arrington had worked for very much in campaigns, was very close to, decided to resign his seat to accept some sort of a judgeship up in Cook County, and he maneuvered, pulled enough strings to get Arrington appointed, or at least appointed to the ballot vacancy for that seat. And Arrington won because that was the big deal. If whoever the Republican candidate was at that time, he was going to get elected. So Arrington actually got elected to the House in the 1944 election, and then the rest is history. He served 10 years in the House of Representatives. In 1954, he moved up. He got elected to the Senate, and he remained in the Senate until his last term expired in 1972.
Yeah. What were his relationships like with the powerful Democrats of the day in the 1960s, notably Richard J. Daley and Otto Kerner?
Okay, he was a real pain, Kerner, okay? When I first came here as a young reporter, very green, all I heard was from the Kerner people were complaints about Arrington, you know, Arrington this, Arrington the obstructionist, we can't do anything because of Arrington, you know. If Arrington doesn't approve, we can't do this, we can't do that. Everything revolved around Arrington. From Arrington's point of view, you know, Kerner was a nice guy, but he didn't really understand much about Illinois state government, and he was really misguided in a lot of his programs and policies. And, you know, he just needed, there just had to be a monitor over everything the Kerner administration did, and that was Arrington. All the Republicans had then was the state Senate, but that was enough. I've said, and many people do not argue, that really Arrington was never governor, but he was almost like the governor in the 1960s because nothing could happen here without his approval. And, you know, it couldn't get through the state Senate. But it was a very antagonistic relationship. He and Daley had public spats. They would argue, and Daley would call Arrington arrogant and unresponsive and an obstructionist again and things like that. And of course, Arrington, like most Republicans at that time around Chicago, were very anti the Democratic machine in Chicago, and it was almost pro forma that you criticized Daley, you tried to second-guess Daley, and Arrington did play that role. Now, however, if we have time, I can tell you, though, I was furnished all the scrapbooks from all the Arrington years. Every time his name appeared anywhere, he had associates, secretaries in the Chicago office that put everything in the scrapbooks, and in there, it was funny, I saw a lot of private little notes that would come from Mayor Daley, this is the first Mayor Daley, to Arrington, and they were very conciliatory and cordial, and things like, Russ, don't get too worked up over this, I don't want you to have a heart attack, you know, stuff like that, and it just indicates that some of the public stuff was shallow, was not totally real, because they had a fairly sociable relationship behind the scenes. Also, one of the poignant chapters in the book starts with the fact that in 1975 or 76, by then Arrington was recovering from a serious stroke. Kerner had just gotten out of prison, and he was a very sick man. He was definitely going to die within several months. And Preston Bradley, then a prominent minister in Chicago, invited the two of them to come together one night to his house on one of those very cold Chicago nights. And the chapter starts off with these two men helping, one walking with a cane, the other obviously hobbled, helping each other into the home in Chicago of Reverend Bradley for a very private little dinner. And the two men are Kerner and Arrington. And it said, that night, all the old antagonisms from nearly a decade were gone. And obviously there were two men helping each other. And Arrington resurrected the night in his memoirs, and he said that he asked Kerner, he said, Otto, is there anything I can do for you? And Otto said, there's not a thing you can do for me, Russ. I'm a sick man. I'm going to die. And then, but he said, still as bad as he was off, Arrington had a tough time walking because of a stroke, and he had a cane. And Arrington said that Kerner helped him through the snow into the house and then back out to the car that night, the whole bit. It was very touching, Celeste, here that after all these years, these two men that were the big antagonists in Illinois government in the 1960s, both near the end of their lives, were kind of helping each other that night into that private little dinner thing in Chicago.
I got one last question for you.
Sure.
And I'll have to ask you to give me 30 seconds, 60 seconds top. That is parallels between the late 1960s and today in the Illinois State House.
It's a good question. I think we had, I'm going to use the word statesmanship back then in the end, in that people had differences, but they could sit down, they could talk about it. They put the personality differences, sometimes the personality clashes, aside, and in the end, they did not let those dictate what was happening or not happening. Right now, we have a different situation. It's extremely polarized in the Illinois State House, just as public life is polarized in much of the country. And the polarization is even further aggravated by some very sharp personality clashes, actually outright dislike at the top of Illinois government by major individuals. Mm-hmm. And this has led to a stymieing of meaningful resolution of the big issues right now facing the state.
Mm. There, we've got to leave it. Thank you very much for talking with us this
evening. Sure. Thank you, Celeste.
Taylor Pensino has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Powerhouse, Errington from Illinois. The book is a Heritage Special Edition from the American Literary Press, and net proceeds from the sales of the book are being donated to the Robert R. McCormick Boys and Girls Club.